Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
When people eat ribs, often I hear that I just took a bite and the whole thing fell off and the bone was in my hand. And I say, boy, that wouldn't get a very high score.
Lynn Schwartzberg is an official judge for the Kansas City Barbecue Society. She comes in today to talk about characteristics of really great barbecue. And she explains why that falling off the bone rib doesn't meet the standard. Harvest Public Media examines how plants communicate with one another to survive extreme weather conditions. And in the kitchen, Chef Daniel Orr uses rhubarb to make a spread that will be nice on a cheese plate and a sauce to drizzle over fresh strawberries. Nice. Stay with us. Food news headlines kick off every show. Anna Coogan is here.
We follow these three stories this week. Chinese company Shuanghui has offered to purchase American pork producer Smithfield for $4.7 billion. If the deal is approved, it would be the largest Chinese takeover of an American company. Traditionally, the Chinese diet has consisted of rice and vegetables, but the Chinese middle class has a growing appetite for pork. Chinese producers have been unable to keep up with demand, so Chinese companies are looking elsewhere. Smithfield's website boasts that its livestock unit is the world's largest hog producer. It owns 460 farms and has contracts with more than 2,000 others across 12 U.S. states. C. Larry Pope, Smithfield's chief executive, said in a statement that the company does not anticipate any changes in how it does business operationally in the U.S. and throughout the world. Shuanghui found itself in the middle of a food scandal 2 years ago. The company recalled tainted pork over concern that it contained a banned feed additive called clenbuterol. Genetically modified wheat created by Monsanto was not approved by the USDA. So then why was it discovered on an Oregon farm last month? The wheat was field tested from 1998 to 2005. It was pulled from the regulatory approval process over concern that the 10 biggest red spring wheat importers wouldn't accept modified varieties. On Thursday, Japan suspended imports of American wheat. The European Union will also recommend countries test American wheat. And more about Monsanto. Protesters all over the world demonstrated against the agribusiness giant last Saturday. Tammy Canal founded March Against Monsanto. She told USA Today that if 3,000 people had joined the protest, she would have considered it a success. What resulted were protests in 52 countries and 436 cities. Earth Eats' James Gray visited the March Against Monsanto rally in Indianapolis.
I arrived at the city market in downtown Indianapolis at around 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. I was watching 50 to 75 people gathered around a small stage at the city market where keynote speakers and bands were performing. The crowd seemed rather tired, which makes sense if they had been marching since 2 o'clock that afternoon, but they still had enthusiasm. Many of them were wearing costumes such as a banana outfit. One onlooker named Patience expressed her gratitude that the event would happen in Indianapolis.
I mean, Indiana's a trickle-down state. This is happening nationwide today. It's incredible because once it comes to Indiana, that means a change is happening.
Jennifer Seffrin was a speaker at the event, and she too was excited about what she saw.
I said to a couple of people at the beginning, I'm like, it's so fun, like seeing this eclectic group of people coming together all for, you know, a common cause.
For Earth Eats, I'm James Gray.
See photos from the Indianapolis March Against Monsanto event on our website and read more news stories. EarthEats.org.
And follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook to get news updates, recipes, and food conversation all week. Search for Earth Eats. Anna Coogan, thanks for the news.
You got it.
As climate change continues to wreak havoc on weather patterns, crop scientists have been working to engineer plants better suited to extremes. But some researchers think we might be overlooking plants' own solutions. Reporting from Nebraska for Harvest Public Media, Hillary Stowes Krause explains.
Ever know someone who talks to plants? Maybe it was your offbeat neighbor cooing at his African violets. Maybe your grandmother analyzed baseball with her cucumbers. Seems a bit silly, but researchers say farmers should maybe take notice.
Personally, I believe that whatever humans continue to do repeatedly over a long time, and we have been talking to plants for a very long time, it's always worth checking out scientifically, just because often what we do so consistently and repeatedly is because it works.
Dr. Monica Galliano is a research fellow at the Center for Evolutionary Biology at the University of Western Australia. Her research found that plants aren't only listening, they're also talking, so to speak.
What we have found is scientific evidence to demonstrate that plants actually do emit their own sound, but beside that, they also respond to the same frequency that they emit themselves. Those particular frequencies are telling something.
I think it's fair to say we're constantly have been surprised at how complex plants are.
That's Michael Fromm. He's with the Center for Plant Science Innovation at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Fromm researches something that might sound like science fiction at first. He studies plant memory. It all began when he was looking into drought tolerance, a key concern for farmers these days. One day, Fromm and his collaborators noticed some plants' drought-responsive genes looked different than others in a greenhouse. They theorized it was from previous stress those particular plants experienced. Turns out, they were right. Experiments showed the plants with the strange-looking genes were holding on to a memory of drought from a few days prior.
So the difference is, after 2 hours, plants being stressed the first time are quite wilted, and plants that are being stressed the second time wilt very little.
The plants with memory of drought knew to conserve what water they had, while the plants new to drought weren't prepared. Galliano says we have a bad habit of underestimating plants. The idea of plant communication, for example, had been hypothesized for decades, but often was met with skepticism or outright hostility by the scientific community. But Galliano says, unlike earlier research, she and her collaborators use the same high-tech equipment approved to study animals' oral communication. And while there aren't massive tomes of evidence yet,
the evidence that is there, it's already so compelling that it would be absolutely madness to just be so narrow-minded to discount it.
She points to related research into the thousands of plant species that have co-evolved with animal species, like blueberries or tomatoes.
And they're known for their ability to release pollen only and exclusively when they're buzzed at the right frequency by a specific bee. In fact, this is called buzz pollination, and a lot of the growers have learned that, and they are mimicking what the animals are doing to release the pollens out of these species, which will not release otherwise.
So what does all this mean? Fromm says research into how plants form drought memory could help scientists create more water-efficient plants and crops. Galliano hopes to build the knowledge base of plant frequencies to the point where, theoretically, we could use sound to keep plants healthy instead of insecticide or pesticide. Galliano's talk of frequencies beyond human hearing made me think of dog whistles. Might we someday have farmers walking through the fields blowing plant whistles, I ask her?
I like the idea. I don't know. Possible.
Galliano says more research is needed, but she thinks the science community is turning over a new leaf when it comes to plant study. She calls it a green revolution. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Hilary Stowes-Krause.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the fram sauce with the awesome fee, with shafafa on the side. I don't want pork chops and bacon that won't awaken.
Memorial Day is the unofficial start of grilling season, one of our favorite times of the year. We wanted to kick off the season right with a conversation about barbecue. And that's where food writer and caterer Lynn Schwartzberg comes in. She's an official judge for the Kansas City Barbecue Society, a job that has her traveling all over the Midwest tasting competition-level meats. Schwartzberg stopped by the Earth Eats studios to talk about what sounds like possibly the most delicious job of all time. How did you get
so interested in barbecue, not just eating it, but so interested that you wanted to become a judge?
Boy, I've enjoyed judging food. I always feel that you have to bring a certain degree of objectiveness to your judging, whether it be the annual salsa contest, a local pie contest. It can't be based on what you like very specifically. It has to be based on a standard. And I was invited, it was a wonderful event, to be a backyard barbecue judge in French Lick during their sanctioned Kansas City Barbecue Society event. And in order to be an official judge of official entries, you had to have already taken the class, passed the test, become an official judge. But lay people or media or whoever could judge backyard category, which were not official teams. Well, I sat with a table of newspaper writers, food purveyors, and it was a blast. And I observed very carefully the official judging tables and thought, this is what I must do. It's my calling. I have always thought of smoked meat and the burnt outer crusty edges as nirvana. So I thought, I have found it.
You found your world.
Yes, yes.
So the class and then the test that happens to get your certification, I'm curious to hear about that process.
Classes are offered throughout the year by Kansas City Barbecue Society or KCBS. And we took an all-day class. We learned all of the specifics of judging and what the standard is to judge by, because every time you judge an entry, you learn to judge by the standard. There is no relative judging. Well, I like this one better than that one. It has nothing to do with that. And then we said the oath of a barbecue judge.
Which I have to hear it.
It's hysterical. And it is said before every single judging event throughout the country. I do solemnly swear to objectively and subjectively evaluate each barbecue meat that is presented to my eyes, my nose, my hands, and my palate. I accept my duty to be an official KCBS certified judge so that truth, justice, excellence in barbecue and the American way of life may be strengthened and preserved forever.
This is a very serious job that you have.
Yeah, I feel like Superman every time I read that. Truth, justice, the American way. And I do typically wear my T-shirt that I got from the Illinois pork producers at an event in Illinois that says, I dig the pig. So I always wear that one because it's the pork that kind of is the core. It is the backbone of barbecue.
Well, we're going to talk about all the different meats that you can eat and the rubs and the sauces and that sort of thing. Part of the oath was you promised to judge with subjectivity. But it sounds like if you're basing your judging on criteria and a standard, that there's no subjectivity about it.
For example, we judge for appearance, taste, and tenderness. So on the criteria for tenderness, we have a way to evaluate meat that could perhaps be overcooked, where you can take a small piece of pulled pork or chicken, for example, and put it between the tongue of your and the roof of your mouth, and it can almost turn to this mushy blob. We all know what that is like. This is not such a good thing. There's a thinking, especially in the Midwest, and most of that comes from Chicago, that falling off the bone is a good thing. Well, it can be too much of a good thing.
Really?
Because when the meat becomes just a paste in your mouth, it loses on texture. It has absolutely no – it's not substantive and it's not fun to eat. So that's the standard. But within that standard, if the person used a creative rub, if they – perhaps they brined their meat before they smoked it. Those parts are subjective to a degree. Where it's not subjective is if I'm not crazy about a citrus marinade and it's a citrus marinade. Whether I like it or not shouldn't really be a factor, but whether it worked for the finished balanced product is a bit of subjectivity.
Okay. All right. So then we're talking about ribs a little bit right now. Describe to me what the standard says a perfect pork rib would be and then also, you know, what you're looking for personally.
Sure. When people eat ribs, often I hear that I just took a bite and the whole thing fell off and the bone was in my hand. And I say, boy, that wouldn't get a very high score. What should happen officially, according to the standard of judging, is the you should bite into a rib and be able to take a clean bite, but the rest of the meat should remain on the bone. If you pull it off and the entire thing falls off, way overcooked. If you have to tug and you feel like a dog with a bone and you're tugging on it, not so well made. Somewhere is that perfect place where you take a bite, it's tender, the bite comes off in your mouth, the rib remains on the bone, and you have perfect barbecue.
So, okay, do you know how to make the perfect barbecue rib?
I do.
Give us some pointers.
The first thing you need to do is prepare your slab, removing that silver skin from the back, or what we look at as that thin white film over the back of the bones. There's a very simple way of pulling it all off in one piece. If you leave it there, it will prevent the seasoning and all of that wonderful rub and all of the smoke that you're putting on the meat from getting into the meat. So when you remove that, it opens the backside of the meat to all of that wonderful flavor. You also want to pierce, and I learned a lot of this from Chris, pierce between all of the rib bones with the end of a fork or something to also add more area, more pores to where flavor can enter the meat. Low and slow, they always say that with barbecue, and it is true. You want to start your smoker with hardwood charcoal and a nice slather of yellow mustard, which was the one moment where I thought, I am not doing this. It is basically the foil for the flavor. The yellow mustard burns off. It imparts no flavor, but it gives that beautiful bark a place to start. So you slather on that yellow mustard and sprinkle your rub, whatever it is, whether you make it yourself, whether you purchase a rub from a championship team, whatever that rub is, sprinkle it on. Too heavily, you're going to have such salty food, you're not going to want to eat it. And then let it smoke, low and slow.
Like, how slow are we talking? How long is this going to take?
It's going to smoke at about 140 is about as high. Well, 140 is the internal temperature. 225 is where you want that smoker to be. You don't want to go much above that. What I learned, actually, though, is once the meat gets to a certain point, you can bring it inside and finish it in the oven. What you don't want to do is start in the oven or start on the stovetop where people parboil and then finish on the smoker and think you're going to have a good product, because it doesn't work in reverse.
Okay. Good advice for people out there.
Yeah.
We've got four categories of barbecue,
yes.
So I want to talk about this.
Yes.
Let's see if I can do this. Kansas City, Carolinas, Memphis, and Texas.
That's pretty good.
The primary? What did I miss?
Those are primary. Well, the Carolinas are kind of split. You've got the vinegar Carolinas and you've got the mustard Carolinas. And then you've got those North Alabamas with the white sauce, which I've never fully understood.
What's in a white sauce?
It's a mayonnaise-based sauce. I have never gotten my head around it, and I think it requires travel.
Oh, boy.
Because I feel like I must get inside of the head of that barbecue.
Well, let's start with Kansas City. What are the specs of Kansas City barbecue?
Kansas City barbecue... Kansas City is ribs. Kansas City sauce is tomato-based. People think of what they buy in the grocery store, that big bottle of brown, Swedish, tangy stuff. That's where Kansas City is. Memphis mustard, classic, beautiful ribs, beautiful pork. South Carolina vinegar-based, that's where you have places like Scott's, where you have a clear, very peppery sauce. The pulled pork is served oftentimes with slaw on top. It's wonderful.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, those are great. And Texas. Texas is brisket country for me. When I think Texas, it's beef.
Well, like, describe
yes.
the quality of brisket.
The interesting thing about brisket is if you slice it in the right direction, which is across the grain, you will have beautiful, tender slices of meat. If you slice it with the grain, you will have long, stringy things that you can't figure out what to do with. And I have seen it sliced wrong, and it's quite unfortunate. Mm-hmm. But brisket is the trickiest meat to cook because it doesn't have nearly as much fat as, say, a pork shoulder. What I did learn from Chris Marks is that we cook a brisket, we smoke it fat side down. And we always thought we put the fat up, it trickles in, it keeps the meat juicy. No.
What was his reasoning?
I don't remember. But it's in my notebook. I should have brought my notes. But he did teach us a cute little thing is we trim a corner off that shows the direction of where you slice, because once that brisket is fully smoked and it's this big black-looking mass, you forget where the grain, you can't see the grain, but you have this little notch at the end where you can start slicing and it'll be perfect. Mm-hmm. So we always notch our brisket now. I thought, what a tricky little thing. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Lynn Schwartzberg is a food writer for the Herald Times in Bloomington. You're a caterer as well, and we learned a whole lot about barbecue from you today because you're a Kansas City Barbecue Society official judge.
That's correct.
Awesome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Hear my complete conversation with Lynn Schwartzberg on our website, eartheats.org. Also, keep an eye on beef prices before you fire up the grill. Purdue researchers are anticipating prices increasing on beef for the third year in a row. Coming up, cooking with rhubarb.
It's almost like celery now, kind of crisp and crunchy. But as it cooks slowly, you can add a little more water if you need to. It will become very, very soft and mushy.
Almost like an apple butter. Chef Daniel Orr has two rhubarb recipes just ahead.
Cornbread and butter beans, and you cross the table. Eating them beans and making love as long as I am able. Hoeing corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride the mule and cut the fool and love begin all over. Goodbye.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. A compote is basically fruit cooked down with sugar. Add whatever seasonings you like, and your compote could work just as well as a dessert as in a first-course cheese plate. We'll be using rhubarb today, which is not actually a fruit, it's a vegetable. Unlike some vegetables, you definitely cannot eat the leaves on a rhubarb plant. They're toxic. But waste not, want not. Chef Orr suggests grinding the leaves down and using them as a bug repellent.
Now, I grow rhubarb in my garden, and you can see it right here. It has a long stem, almost like celery, and then a big, big leaf, almost like an elephant's ear. What you normally do is get a nice big crop of rhubarb in the late spring, early summer, and then you let the plant grow back through the late summer and into the fall, and that what that does is it re-nourishes the root system, so then next spring you'll have more rhubarb. So you don't want to cut your rhubarb too late into the season. All right, so we bring the rhubarb into the kitchen. What we're going to do is slice it up, and today we're going to make a rhubarb compote, but you could use it in many of the same ways that you use an apple butter. Again, you could serve it with pork, you could serve it with duck, or you can use it as a pie filling like we're going to be using today. And rhubarb has kind of a sweet, sour flavor, so it does work well with meats that have some fat in them. Also would be good with game. Okay, to this we're going to add some sugar, and that will start pulling out the moisture in the rhubarb. A little bit of lemon juice in there to get it going. Again, playing off that sour flavor. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to let this cook down until it almost purees itself. It's almost like celery now, kind of crisp and crunchy. But as it cooks slowly, you can add a little more water if you need to. It will become very, very soft and mushy and then turn into almost like an apple butter consistency. What we have here is a pre-baked tart shell. This is puff pastry. We're going to fill the inside with some of this rhubarb and top it with the strawberries. Now what I've done is I've macerated the strawberries with a little bit of strawberry jam so they're nice and shiny. All right, a couple sprigs of mint, and you've got a perfectly wonderful, easy dessert that just tastes like summer in Indiana. So we're going to kind of do a deconstructed strawberry rhubarb pie, we're going to turn it into a soup instead of a pie, but we're going to have those wonderful flavors. The rhubarb, of course, nice and red, that's going to give us a nice color, and basically what we're going to make is a consommé, which with the rhubarb, and then we're going to pour it over the strawberries.
Okay, define consommé.
Well, consommé is a clear, kind of a clear soup. This will be more like a syrup because it's sweet. So we're just going to rough chop the rhubarb. And you only use the stem. The leaf is poisonous.
Don't eat the leaf.
All right, so don't eat the leaf.
Put that away.
All right, we're going to pour the rest of the rhubarb in there. Then we've got some aromatics that we're going to put in. We've got some cinnamon stick. And cinnamon stick, I always like to just break it a little bit, and that will bring out more of the flavors. We've got some sliced ginger, some white wine, about a cup and a half. We've got about a cup of sugar. And we're going to add a cup of water. And we're going to bring that to the stove, let it boil, and then let it sit for about a half an hour, and then strain it off.
Chef, what is this? Candied orange peel?
Yeah, that's a candied orange peel. We're going to put that in as part of the garnish. And then we've got some mint, and then we've got our wonderful strawberries.
Okay.
So while the syrup cooks, we can put the strawberries in the bowl.
What do you suppose it is about strawberries and rhubarb that just go so well together?
Well, I think it's the acidic flavor of the rhubarb with those nice, sweet, sun-ripened strawberries. You know, just kind of a match made in heaven. And again, this is not a real Annie dessert because there's no chocolate involved.
Chocolate in it.
And again, this would be great with a rhubarb sorbet or vanilla ice cream. It would be perfect. So let me just get the syrup and we'll finish up.
Great.
Very pretty and very simple. Looking on our website, so many rhubarb recipes from which to choose, so many. There's no-bake tart, two different pie recipes, a ginger rhubarb crisp. Keep an eye out for some rhubarb at your farmer's market this week, and maybe make one of these tasty recipes. Find them all and so much more at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Anna Coogan, James Gray, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Lynn Schwartzberg, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, Therapeutic Massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years. Building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900. Or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for tuning in today, guys. Hope the weather allows for some grilling. Till next week, I'm Annie Corrigan.